Blog Talk Radio.
If it's Sunday, it's Wrestling Night in America on PWTorchDailyCast.com. Good Sunday evening for, what are we at, July 24th? Yes, 2022. I am Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. And we have a lot to talk about tonight. And I did some talking on Monday, too, after the Monday Night Raw. I joined Wade Keller, and we talked about that show. So if you have not listened, I don't do a lot of post shows, but I did get a chance to talk to him about Raw. So if you haven't listened to that, I heartily endorse that. And it's very newsworthy. I don't know what else to say. It's just, you know, with the Vince McMahon stuff and Death Before Dishonor and SummerSlam coming up next week, and I'm a little frazzled because I'm calling old school on my phone because about 15 minutes before I went on air, I realized that something had chewed through the wiring on my headset, and it was no longer usable. So this is, you know, we're winging it here on a Sunday night, I guess, is the best way to put it. So if you want to call in, 515-605-9345. If you want to just hang on the line and listen, you're welcome to do so. If you'd like to interact with me and my co-host, who I'm about to bring on here, make sure to press 1. You can also email wnialivecast@gmail.com. And you know, we'll talk about the G1. We'll talk about the Death Before Dishonor card. We'll talk about SummerSlam. And we will be joined right now by my co-host for this evening, Kelly Wells, PWTorch.com contributor. Kelly, thank you for joining me tonight.
Good to be here. First and foremost, I apologize for chewing through the wire on your headset.
It was you. It was you all along.
Just a petty thing to do, but a pure career move, you understand.
Completely.
Yeah, it's loving the G1 so far, so I'm going to gush almost to a maudlin degree about the format and liked Death Before Dishonor, and maybe there will be something else to talk about.
Well, let's lead off with that something else. I'm sure, as we talked about in the DMs on Twitter, this is probably the 1,000th podcast to talk about Vince McMahon retiring, but, we talk about the big shows in pro wrestling, so this isn't really necessarily under our umbrella, but it's just too big a news to ignore. It's probably the biggest news story of the time that I've been watching wrestling. I mean, you know, you think about what else compares, you know, the Chris Benoit murder-suicide, maybe the Owen Hart accident and death, and WWE buying WCW are all, I think, contenders, but this is the man who has shaped the industry as we know it today, and in all aspects, business, creative, and everything. And Vince McMahon announcing on Friday that he would be retiring, effective immediately, assuming, and that includes his creative duties, which he had not stepped back from like he had from the CEO, chairman of the board duties. So, you know, Kelly, your just reaction, I think it's going to be one of those things that we remember what we were doing when we heard that news, and just kind of your initial reaction to Vince retiring.
I saw that one pretty much when it dropped in. I work. So a couple of years ago, I was thinking, man, I got to find a way to be on my phone a little less because it just depresses me being on it so often. And then I get into a line of work where I'm basically required to be on it about 8 to 10 hours a day. So I don't miss a lot of news in real time. I was looking for a way to price something that I was selling in my shop, and that dropped in, and my brother works there as well. And I just turned to him and said, dude, it happened. And he said, Vince. And he wasn't looking at his phone, and he just knew because we'd been talking about it enough. It's hard to wrap your head around it when I was just at work. I didn't really have the time to digest it, but it was just like, it's hard to wrap your head around the number of things that can and will change, and how fast those could be, and just how much he was influencing the product. Because, I mean, fans have been talking about the changes that would come. And I think in recent years, fans have been talking about the positive changes that would come when he was out of the way, because he seemed at times out of touch with what today's wrestling fan wants. But now that it happens, it's like, is this going to work out? Gosh, this is everything that people have been talking about for at least a couple of decades. And it's very, I don't want to miss a minute of what they're going to put on TV just to see what those changes are.
And Friday, SmackDown was really the first show without Vince at the helm. And it didn't feel all that different, although you could probably assume that SmackDown had been written beforehand. You know, if that's a show that's known to be rewritten the day of, but without Vince, I don't know if that's going to happen as often, and it probably did not happen here. So you'll probably be looking toward Raw on Monday for a real fresh show without Vince's fingerprints on it. You know, my reaction, I actually saw it at a stoplight. My girlfriend and her son and I were coming back from kayaking. And, you know, you're sitting at a, you know, it's a long red light, you'll check Twitter and whatever, and I saw the tweet. And my first instinct was to, okay, check the blue check mark. Yep, is this a, you know, is this a parody account? Is this a, you know, because you get caught with some of those sometimes. And then you start thinking about it. It's like Friday, 4 p.m. This is exactly when an announcement like this would be made if you were to make it. So that, I think, added to the realism of the moment. And, you know, you look and it's real. And it takes you a few minutes to process exactly what that means, you know, and your head is spinning because you're thinking of all the angles on this. You know, you're thinking of, why is he doing it now? Is there something worse that he knows is going to come out, or that he was pressured to resign? Is this, you know, how is the business end going to change? Who's going to take over? We found out that Nick Khan and Stephanie McMahon were named co-CEOs. You know, what's creative going to look like? What's Vince going to do with all this time that he has now that he's not running WWE, which, you know, he's never really done in his adult life? So it's just, there were just so many things running through your head as to, you know, what do I think about first? What angle do I take when I think about this news? And it's even today, 2 days later, you're still thinking about the ripple effects that this will have on so many things, you know, even just analyzing the business. You know, the people who've been in this the longest, the Meltzers, the Kellers, everybody like that, has gotten so attuned to what a Vince McMahon product looks like, what a Vince McMahon wrestler looks like, what he looks for in his talent, what his fingerprints on a show specifically look like. And now all of that knowledge is kind of out the window. And you're no longer looking through Raw, SmackDown, and pay-per-views through the lens of a Vince McMahon. You know, you still may do that to a certain extent because Bruce Pritchard being in charge is a longtime lieutenant of Vince's. There's no telling that he's going to, you know, completely revamp the product. And a lot of the people who are writing, Ed Koski, head writer of SmackDown, has been writing under Vince for a long time. You know, so are they just so ingrained in the ways that Vince taught them that they don't really know any other way to present the product other than the way that Vince has? Even though you hear a lot of times, you know, writers saying it, and how difficult it is, and wrestlers saying how difficult it is to write and to perform for an audience of one, you know, what is that then going to look like? And how vastly different will the product be? How soon? Will it be Monday? Will not see, you know, that effect in weeks, months, maybe? It's just, like, I have a hard time thinking about even talking to you, Kelly, and saying, you know, how do you narrow down the topics? You could do a five-hour podcast just about this news. You know, how do you pare it down to talk about it for, like, 5 minutes?
Yeah, While you were talking, I thought of about 8 different talking points, which is proof of what you were saying right there. And even setting aside the fact that Vince worked closely with a lot of the talent that is there that's been creating TV, I think it's even bigger than that. I think it's very difficult for any wrestling promotion to exist without accidentally doing all these things that Vince does that are Vince-isms that maybe they don't even realize that that these things all came from WWE. Just the way that it's produced, the way that it's presented, I think a lot of when the first episode of AEW, after months of being told this is going to be a massive, just a different flavor than WWE is, I watched it and I said, you know what that felt a lot like is WWE, in a lot of really specific ways. And they've done something of a job of moving away from that. But I think that so much of wrestling has been written and the way that announcers talk, I just think all these wrestlers and other talents, writing talents and people like that who want to be in the product have kind of molded themselves in the way that would catch the eye of a Vince McMahon, because for so long that was the only game in town. And you knew you were kind of auditioning for the audience of one. I think we're going to feel like we're seeing Vince-isms for years, for many years. And to the point where online folk are going to be saying, Vince still has his hand in this, even if he doesn't. And I think it'll be more likely that he won't, but how can it not be like the stuff he created and did for so long?
Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing. He's got 80% voting power still, when it comes to the stock. So does that mean that he's still going to have some say? Are Stephanie McMahon and Nick Khan still going to be making business decisions that either Vince directs from, the shadow ownership, or that, they think that he would want? And that's same with creative, is Bruce Prichard going to be leading creative for as long as he's going to be doing it? We don't know how long he's going to be in charge, but he's the guy right now. Is he still going to be making decisions based on what Vince would want? We don't know how involved or not involved Vince will be with his 80% voting power. So this is, we could go on forever. We're not going to, because we have a lot of other stuff to get to tonight. And there are a lot of other podcasts in the PW Torch family that talked about this and will talk about this. So I implore you to check those out. But again, too big of a news not to at least touch on here for the first few minutes of Wrestling Night in America. If you're just tuning in, Greg Parks, Kelly Wells with you here on Wrestling Night in America. 515-605-9345 is where you can go to call. Press 1 if you'd like to talk. Otherwise, you can stay on the line. And WNIALivecast@gmail.com is where you can go to send your emails to us. So before we get to Death Before Dishonor, I'll go to the phones first, because Reverend Keith always kind of, he's able to somehow predict what we're about to talk about. So maybe we can talk about some of the things he wants to talk about and cross it off our list for what we have to talk about in the future. So Reverend Keith, Baltimore, Maryland, is with us. Reverend Keith, thanks for joining us tonight.
Thank you for having me, Greg and Spooky Milk. It's always a joy to talk to you as well.
Yes, very funny to be called by my screen name in real life. That hasn't, I don't know if that's happened since college.
Hey, I try to be different from everyone else and unique, so that's a good thing. Hey, it's always good to talk to you guys. Listen, let's delve right into Death Before Dishonor. I thought that it was a very good show. It really was. Now, I must say that Ian Riccaboni and Caprice Coleman did a stellar job. They really made that show so much better than what it was. I love their the pairing, the excitement, and the just the dynamic that the two of them bring. from a commentary standpoint, they really delve into the history, the backstories, the things that most incoming Ring of Honor fans have no clue to the story past of Claudio Castagnoli when he was in Ring of Honor the first time, the history between Joe and Lethal. So they brought out a lot. What were your thoughts on the dynamic in the commentary, the overall production value in which AEW presented last night? What were your thoughts before we delve into the matches?
Commentary was good as always. I like Ian, I like Caprice, and I think you're right. They did add a lot, especially to the main event. I thought they did a fantastic job calling that match in particular. Production-wise, I thought it was real good. ROH's production has not been their strong suit in previous eras, and I thought they shot this arena very well. It looked like a full house on camera, and it looked like a really good crowd on camera. It was very well lit, from opposite the hard camera. Once they shot to the side, you could see it was darkened a little bit, and based on pictures that have surfaced online, it didn't look like there was anyone on the hard camera side. But again, you don't notice that just watching on television. That's a sign of good production when they can mask where there are not people. So they took what I think was a pretty small venue in Lowell, and they made it look big league, I thought. And that's the key here is you've got to give it a big league feel. And I thought the production did that last night, Kelly.
Yes, I like this announcing team too. I think they're great together. And when they're not together, I've been getting quite a big helping of Rick Abani recently because he's also doing New Japan Strong, which I also never miss. He usually calls that with either Matthew Raywalt, formerly known as Aiden English, or Alexi. Oh gosh, I'm going to kick myself. It'll come to me later when it doesn't matter anymore. But they're so I get a lot of Rick Abani, and he's just he's a straight man without feeling robotic at all times, and he does seem to be kind of that old school voice of the people. Caprice is just fun. He's fun to listen to, and I love that he saved his one, oh, my God, which is about my favorite call
yes.
in all of wrestling.
Yes.
He saved
yes,
one big one for the main event. But, yeah, I like these two a lot. If I was just watching this show without the benefit of knowing that Tony had bought Ring of Honor, I definitely would have thought, okay, it's Ring of Honor, but they found some money somewhere. That's what I would have thought. I looked great. I thought it sounded great. And just as Greg said, they shot the place extremely well.
Yes. My second point that I would like to mention is that I like how they rounded out the card. I'm a huge fan of both Dragon Lee and his brother Roosh, and I thought they brought it last night. It was a really good match. They gave 100%, and I think it surprised a lot of the fans, especially those who were watching. Those in attendance, that particular building in Lowell, Massachusetts, has hosted numerous Ring of Honor classics over the years, so I'm sure they were used to this. But I mean, I like how they rounded out the card with not only that match, but even Dalton Castle and the boys. I'm a huge Dalton Castle fan. I was excited to see them capture those six-man titles. That was one of the more shocking aspects of the night because I didn't see that one coming, simply because it was a match that they just announced, number one. And number two, I wasn't sure if they were going to keep the belt on Bateman and his group and try to bring on Shane Taylor Promotions or have Prince Nana's group challenge for those six-man titles. So I was happy to see that because Dalton Castle is Ring of Honor. Dragon Lee and Roosh, they're Ring of Honor. And, so it was good to see that they would go back into 2020, 2021 and bring out some of the stars that you may not see as often on AEW television, but pure Ring of Honor faithful followers know who these people are. So it was good to see how they rounded out the card. What were your thoughts on that?
I thought the undercard was really strong. I thought the Dalton Castle match was the one that I didn't really feel all that invested in because, you know, and this is a symptom of ROH not having television. That is a match you probably would have had built up on TV every week and put on this show. But, you know, because you're building up this ROH pay-per-view on AEW TV and there's only so many segments that you can devote to ROH on AEW TV, a match like this isn't going to get any time. So you go into it blind, and I'm not, you know, I confess I was not a huge viewer of Ring of Honor. I wasn't a viewer of their weekly product. I'm aware of Dalton Castle and the boys, Vincent a little bit, the other guys not so much. So there wasn't really a ton of investment for me in this. But, you know, that being said, it was a decent enough match. It didn't feel out of place among the rest of the matches, and I thought the undercard was well done. I thought, and I said this on Twitter at Greg M. Parks after the show, is I thought this show, from an in-ring standpoint, you could hold this up to some of the stronger AEW pay-per-view cards, and it would be neck and neck with it. You know, I thought from an in-ring standpoint, this was just an absolutely great card. So obviously the Dalton Castle match certainly didn't hurt my enjoyment of the show by any significant stretch, but it was the one match, Kelly, that I felt the least investment in.
So
right, I understand.
I was invested in this match, but yeah, I was invested in the match, but largely that was self-imposed because the last time that I dropped in on ROH for a significant time was for about a 6-month stretch, and the Dalton Castle and the boys thing was going strong right then. In fact, one of the last things I saw was Dalton Castle turning heel on them, and I just thought that was a really bizarre person to turn heel. Still think that was an odd choice, but was glad to see them back together. So it's kind of like I never stepped out of it because we get right back into Dalton Castle and the boys. I've seen a lot of Bateman as well. He's a regular on New Japan Strong also, and has a different 3-man faction there called the Stray Dog Army. I think it's 3, it might be 4. Bandido and Roosh. No, not Bandido and Roosh. Roosh and Dragon Lee. This was
Dragon Lee.
Yeah, this was frightening to me because Dragon Lee I've seen a lot of, and the man is fearless to an almost like I hate to open my eyes sort of way. There was the injury, one of Hiromu Takahashi's 2 major injuries was in a match where he and Dragon Lee were just going at it. They were at 11 for the whole match. I knew it was going to be awesome. I knew that, and these guys have the ultimate trust in each other. So you knew that they weren't going to hold anything back. So, but I mean, what was it? Was it an arm drag or was it where Roosh threw, you think he's going to throw Dragon Lee on the apron like you've seen 1,000 times, but instead he uses it and he just throws him all the way out to the floor. There were just some spots that you don't see a lot. Yeah, as soon as I heard that match was going to happen, I was like, I hope that they both survive it, because if they do, it could be real great.
Yeah. Yes, they have the utmost trust in each other, and I've seen them actually wrestle along with Bandido and La Flamita in a tag team match here in Baltimore about 1.5 years ago, maybe 2 years ago, prior to the pandemic, and they put on a spectacle, you know, because they're all high flyers with the exception of Roosh, you know, with La Flamita and Bandido, whom I wish had been on the card, because I love to see Bandido, but I'm sure we'll see more of him once they get the TV show. But yeah, they have the utmost trust in each other, not just because they're brothers, but also because they wrestled hundreds of times, both in the States and in Mexico. And these guys, they, you know, like you said, they're balls to the wall. They, you know, they have the utmost trust in each other, and they just put their bodies on the line 24/7. So, and it's all for us fans. And I enjoyed. That was a treat for me because I wasn't expecting that match. The Dalton Castle match, that I was excited at the outcome because he's well loved. And it was good to see Brandon back with them. And I see he's picked up some muscle. I a couple of years ago, I stood right beside Brandon, and he was pretty small. Actually, He and I were about the same size, but now he's got me beat. He's put on some muscle, so now he can fly through those ropes with power.
Yeah, they did look older to me for sure. Like I couldn't put my finger on it, but I was like, I don't remember them being so damn manly. Like they were really.
Yeah, Brandon especially has picked up a lot of muscle. He's gained like about looked to be about 15 pounds of muscle.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they, you know, you're impressing a new boss now. You're cosmetically trying to get in shape to potentially be on national television in a way that you may not have been before on ROH, certainly on pay-per-view, but not as a weekly product. So, you know, I think cosmetically all ROH talent are probably wanting to put their best foot forward, trying to get signed to a deal if they're not already signed to a deal, and really awaiting word from Tony Khan about a weekly television show, because I know that's still, you know, the carrot that he's chasing for ROH. Reverend Keith, we'll go back to you for your third and final thought on Death Before Dishonor or whatever else you've got on your mind tonight.
Okay, my third and final point is relative to some of the rumors and maybe the controversial aspects that have come out of Death Before Dishonor. Now, if you noticed, when Jonathan Gresham's music hit, he didn't come out with his typical octopus gear. And it has now surfaced that, and I don't know how true this is what I'm seeing. I don't believe the dirt sheets until I either myself have had an opportunity to find out on my own whether it's true or I've heard it out of 9 out of 10. I figure 9 out of 10, if it's 9 out of 10 that's saying it, normally they're right. But if it's just one or two sources saying it, what I'm hearing today, and you may have heard as well, Kelly and Tom, Kelly and Greg, I'm sorry, is that he has asked for his release from his contract in AEW and Ring of Honor. I know, you know, and I don't know if this is true or not, but if it is true, then they're going to lose a respectable and worthy talent. Jonathan Gresham is one of the more underrated black superstars in all of professional wrestling. And I understood the need to put Claudio over. I predicted that, and I think that was the right move. And I also think it was the right move to bookend that match with the main event with FTR and the Briscoes, which I'll let you guys talk about after I get off the air. But I just think that if these rumors are true, then Tony Khan needs to try to renegotiate and try to keep him, because he has done an impeccable job with that Ring of Honor title, especially during the 4-month hiatus. You know, he was defending that title all over the world, and he put on spectacles, you know, against some of the top-notch independent talent out there. So for them to just let him walk, you know, or for him to be upset enough to want his release, something must be going on, you know. So I just hope and pray that he, you know, he finds a home somewhere, or maybe he can renegotiate with Tony Khan, and that Tony Khan will have a listening ear, because I think you need to keep Jonathan Gresham around, you know. What are your thoughts on this? Thanks for taking my call, and we'll speak again soon.
All right. Thank you, Reverend Keith. Yeah, Kelly, this whole situation, you know, the match went down last night. Kind of strange. It turned into the opening match on the show, the ROH World Championship against Claudio Castagnoli. The finish sort of came out of nowhere. It was almost a little more unceremonious than you would expect. And then you hear the news tonight about Jonathan Gresham quitting ROH/AEW, him saying apparently that he's taking some time off from wrestling. So, you know, this may be an issue that runs deeper than just any disagreement he has with AEW and Tony Khan. So I hate to say too much about it, you know, about Tony Khan needing to try to talk Jonathan Gresham back into being a part of this company. I think he would be a huge asset to ROH whenever they do get TV. But it sounds like there are some issues that maybe go beyond just a disagreement with Tony Khan. And then, so, you know, talk a little bit about that. And then, you know, the match against Castagnoli, I wasn't shocked that Castagnoli won, but the match felt short. The finish sort of came out of nowhere. It just felt a little strange last night.
And it was about 12 minutes long, which is pretty light.
Right.
Considering this is a Tony Khan show, it's very light. But it was also only a 3-hour show, which actually for me is one of the reasons that this was perhaps more enjoyable all around than a lot of the AEW pay-per-views I've seen, just because of the brevity. Was, I mean, this is about how long I want a pay-per-view to be, like a snug 3 hours, with maybe a couple exceptions for your big one. I like Gresham as much as anybody, but when I was watching regularly for some time in 2018 or 19, whatever it was, I thought, I really like this guy, but he'll never hold the top title, like not anywhere, not even here. That is what I thought. He's just an excellent wrestler, but he's not a healthy helping of attitude in any way. He's just kind of a straightforward dude. And so there's that. And then is it 5'4"? You know that in WWE, well, in Vince land, we got to get used to saying that, he wouldn't work out. And I don't know how he would work out in WWE now. We won't know that for a while. But I'm trying to see it from his perspective, because he sees Tony rating all kinds of talent from all over. I mean, dozens and dozens of wrestlers over the course of just weeks, and 100 wrestlers in a year, whatever it is, he's signing everybody, and he never signs Gresham. Gresham is part of the Ring of Honor deal. If Tony had wanted Gresham as a regular, he already would have gotten him. So maybe it could be as simple as Gresham seeing that he's not valued on the level he wants to be. I mean, they already have a hierarchy issue there where, I mean, forget getting a push, just getting on TV is hard for a lot of talent right now. Where's he going to be if he fancies himself even lower on the chain because he wasn't even hired away before Tony bought Ring of Honor? There has to be more than meets the eye. But I don't blame Gresham if he sees a massive company that didn't come calling his name.
And speaking of more than meets the eye, I think they're married, Jordynne Grace, or they're dating, went on Twitter and was seemingly unhappy about the jokes that had been made at Gresham's expense about his height. Gresham deleting his Twitter, as well as the Twitter account of his wrestling promotion, Terminus. That is no longer active, the account, that is. So, you know, when we say this may go deeper than just a disagreement with Tony Khan, I think that's kind of what we're alluding to there. So, yeah, it was a good match, 12 minutes, as you said, almost criminally short, because this is one that I was really looking forward to, Castagnoli versus Gresham, and just forces conspiring to not let it maybe reach its full potential, but still, I thought it was a strong match. We talked about Castle and the boys versus Vincent Bateman and Dutch. Again, you know, I don't want to belabor the point. The only other thing I'll say about this match is, you know, Vincent also appearing on Impact Wrestling as part of the sort of ROH invasion that Impact Wrestling is doing. So it did seem strange to kind of see him on ROH pay-per-view, and I don't think they referenced at all his involvement in Impact Wrestling.
No, if they did, I didn't catch that at all. And for me, at first, it wasn't weird to see him at all, because I think of him as an ROH guy. But ROH and Impact are both kind of glaring blind spots for me at this point, given what I am and am not watching. So that didn't stand out to me at the time.
Yeah. The next match was the Pure Championship, Wheeler Yuta defending against Daniel Garcia and retaining that title, defeating Garcia. Strong match for this style, and my question to you is, who do you think, based on what you've seen so far, has the higher ceiling in professional wrestling? Is it Wheeler Yuta or is it Daniel Garcia? Because they are very similar, you know, similar styles, things like that. Similar in that neither show a ton of traditional wrestling charisma. I think they're charismatic in their own right, but it's not something that jumps off the page like has historically been something that you look for in pro wrestling. So I think their career arcs are going to be kind of similar, and people are going to be comparing them for years to come. So talk a little bit about your impressions of the match and which one of these guys you think has the higher ceiling in pro wrestling.
Yeah, pretty good match here. Went about just short of 16, I think. They helpfully gave that on the screen. I admired their restraint in not going to the ropes. I liked having Regal on commentary. I thought he was really, really in his element here, talking about not only having the best wrestlers, but having them face the best competition, really just putting over both these guys a lot. And I dug the style they worked, and I dug the match thoroughly. I'll go with Wheeler for the higher upside. I think there's a little something more in his look. I think a little more upper card potential. I don't know how high I would say he could go in a really, really crowded company, or really in a crowded, an entirely crowded sport right now. It just seems like he could be a really special part of a show in AEW, in New Japan, because he did the New Japan Best of the Super Juniors and had just a great tournament there a handful of months ago. And Garcia, I think, is very good too. I feel like he's peaking. I don't know how much more there is to this guy, but I think he's a perfectly good mid-card pest, and I think he plays the role better than I expected him to earlier on. Has more unconventional charisma than I would have guessed. I wouldn't die on this hill, but I will pick Yuta since you did ask me to pick one.
Moving on to Rush versus Dragon Lee. Here, Reverend Keith talked a little bit about that match. I like this. First of all, it was fun. It was exciting. It was a dose of lucha on this show. But I think one of the things they did a really nice job on was this show. And what AEW generally does very well on its pay-per-views is to offer several different styles of matches. You know, a lot of 3- and 4-star matches, but they weren't the same 3- and 4-star matches. And so this one, obviously, being a lucha-style match, being a lot more high-flying, a lot more high-risk moves than, contrast it with the Pure title match, for example, that came right before it, obviously very so. I think there's value in just having a good match out there, but also value in having a good match that is a different style than a lot of the other things you're presenting on the card.
Yes, and I felt that same thing. I was reminded of that on, I think it was night 5 of the G1 Climax, where every match had a different flavor, and it seems like they're kind of doing that on purpose. Now, the G1 is a booking nightmare. You probably got to work on that thing practically for months to figure that out, but it seems like they did try to give a different flavor to everything. And if it looks the same on paper, they'll present a match in a way you didn't expect. But I did very much appreciate this about this show. This kind of started with Rush and Dragon Lee. Yes. Just trying to recenter here. Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting so into my head. I'm going so big picture. I've forgotten where we started this question. So yeah, I liked that about this show a lot as well. One of the things I was very worried about with AEW early on was that they were going so hard after work rate. I was a little afraid that they weren't going to have different flavors to offer in their pay-per-views. And some of their pay-per-views, even the good ones, I do feel like I've seen that same high octane sort of feel kind of throughout the card. So it's almost surprising to see something that's so different in this ROH show.
And then you had the lone women's match on the show, Mercedes Martinez defeating Serena Deeb to retain the ROH women's title. I was a little surprised that she retained. I kind of would have predicted Deeb winning given her character and push on AEW. But this is another really solid women's match. They worked holds. This went a little long. I think there's a match on the card that felt long. And you're right, this was not AEW where every match went 30 minutes or anything like that. This was, they pared this down to fit into the three-hour window, actually a little less than that. But if there was a match that felt like it went, you know, maybe 3 to 5 minutes past the mark that it should have, it was this match. But even then, it was still really strong, really well worked. Both of these women have, I think, similar styles, and they've been around long enough. They're two veterans who know how to work a match, and they did a really nice job.
Yeah, if there was only going to be one match that they gave 3 to 5 more minutes than I would have thought, I guess it is kind of cool that it was the only women's match on the show, that they actually gave them a few minutes here. And I'm glad that these two specific women got the time, because they are absolute shortlist of my favorite women in wrestling anywhere. So I was pretty pleased about that. I didn't know whether to be surprised by the result or not, but it is kind of odd that they went so hard with I really liked the Serena Deeb Invitational, where she was just destroying women every week on Rampage. I that was probably my favorite part of Rampage while that was going on. So I'm kind of, yeah, it just seems like a lot was put into Serena. You won't hear me arguing against Mercedes Martinez. I thought that she was, even as well as she was pushed for a while in NXT, I thought she was undervalued. I think she's one of the really good, she was one of the real good talkers they had at a time on Black and Gold, where they had a few good talkers, tons of good wrestlers, but only a handful of really good talkers. And she could give a great fiery promo and just keep it under a minute and just really make her time count. I dug this match. They did a good job. But yes, like you, I was very surprised at the length of this.
Samoa Joe defeated Jay Lethal to retain the TV title. Joe's been off of TV for quite some time. Jay Lethal doing a lot of the heavy lifting in hyping this match on AEW television. I thought it was a good match, not great, but what was your impression of Samoa Joe? You know, did he show some ring rust? Did he seem a step slower from having been out of the ring for a while? Especially at his age and with his body type, you kind of expect that as time goes on, especially if you're not in the ring for a while. Or did he seem pretty fresh and pretty nimble to you?
He looks like Joe for 40 seconds, and then he has to breathe for another 10. That's kind of what I got from Joe. Like, he really, really doesn't want to be losing a step. He doesn't want to be aging, but he is. That's the feeling that I got from him. Because in so many ways, we saw the Samoa Joe that's always been around, but he does seem like he's gasping for it a little bit, but he doesn't want to be blown up. So he's not, I hope that he doesn't kind of go like Flair and stay in the ring for way too long, just because he's obsessed with it. And then really starts to show his, that he just can't hang anymore. Like, my grandpa continuing to go into Napa and like, quote unquote, work into his 80s. And mostly they were just letting him hang around because they liked his personality. I liked that they kind of, I thought it was wise that they did a lot of extracurriculars, brawling, stuff like that, to kind of hide the fact that these guys can't have the banger that they could have had 7 or 8 years ago. But I thought that it was handled, fairly well, given Samoa Joe, whatever's been going on with him, in addition to his just naturally losing a step.
And finally, the main event, FTR defeating the Briscoes to retain the ROH tag titles. 2 out of 3 falls. Just another absolute, you know, and this was, I mean, really, I think you could have had 3 different matches main event. I think you could have had the ROH title, you could have had the TV title, and you could have had the tag titles. You know, it seemed curious at the outset that they had the world title go on first, and then you watched the main event, and you're like, well, it would have been tough to follow this. The the match was excellent. 4 stars plus, probably. FTR is just in a groove right now, you know, and as baby faces, I wasn't sure when they had that turn on Tully Blanchard. And I think that turn was done via video package while I was live at Dynamite in Fort Myers. It seemed like, FTR is baby faces. I don't know. They seem very good at that 80s heel tag team style. And it's been just a tremendous success. They are one of the hottest acts right now in professional wrestling. And the Briscoes showed their worth here. I mean, they were no slouches at all. It was just an excellent match. I'm not sure it reached the point that their previous match did, but it was still up there in that conversation. And just being in that conversation with that one, I think it was WrestleMania weekend, is certainly worthy of a pat on the back. So, Kelly, what did you think of this match and the Briscoes being, you know, signed to long-term ROH deals by Tony Khan? So all the consternation about the Briscoes not being a part of AEW, their future with ROH up in the air seems to have gone by the wayside as well.
Yeah, I'm in agreement of this one being the main event, and I would have said that before I saw the show. This is really how, because they've done that with tag team wrestling before in Ring of Honor, and to great effect, and they've had the talent to really make that work. I was just as worried as you when they decided to turn FTR babyface, and not just worried, but also, I don't want to say resentful, that's too strong a word, but lamentable. You just know that you're missing such a good act when they turn, but maybe these guys are going to be the next Kevin Owens for me. Whenever they turn, or Sami Zayn, you turn and they say, cool, I missed babyface Sammy, but man, heel Sammy sure was awesome. These guys are just guys that can do it on either side of the aisle. So, yes, obviously the match was very strong all the way through, I thought. FTR, I don't know what more I can add that you didn't already say. It's really kind of otherworldly. They're raising... they're raising all of tag team wrestling with their act, and that sounds hyperbolic, but it doesn't feel hyperbolic when I say it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think that's needed. And we've seen that Tony Khan is a fan of tag team wrestling in the same way that Vince McMahon is not. So having FTR and so many great tag teams, this is kind of what it leads to. It leads to tag teams main eventing, and that being the talking point coming out of the show. And so I think that's a good thing. Death Before Dishonor, thumbs up show for me, and I think you as well, Kelly, based on our conversation. 515-605-9345, press 1 if you'd like to chat with us. Phone lines are open. You can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. Kelly, you want to go to the G1? I know you've been watching. I know you've written reports for pwtorch.com on the G1. I am caught up, which has not happened in several years. Still caught up, even through 5 shows. And I will be, you know, here's the tease. At Greg M. Parks on Twitter, I will be watching the next 2 shows, Tuesday morning, Wednesday morning. Both shows, I believe, begin at 5:30 Eastern. I will be tweeting along with those live. So if you are someone who watches New Japan Live, give me a follow. I haven't watched those shows live in a long time, but I'm going to be able to do that. I'll get up at 5:15. I'll make a Dunkin' Donuts run, get some coffee, and settle in for 3 hours of G1. So there you go. Nights 3, 4, and 5 have happened this week since we talked on Wrestling Night in America last Sunday. Night 3 saw Yujiro defeat Dave Finley, Tama Tonga over Chase Owens, Bad Luck Fale over Lance Archer and Goto over Naito. Night 4, Zack Sabre Jr. over Aaron Henare, Shingo Takagi over Yoshihashi, Okada defeating Yano, Jay White over Ishii. And Night 5, El Fantasmo defeating Yujiro, Sanada over Taichi, Cobb defeating Fale, and Tanahashi over Naito. My personal favorite matches, maybe not the best matches, but my personal favorite matches from the... each night, I liked Goto versus Naito from night 3. I think Goto is kind of an underrated guy at this point. Night four, I really liked Takagi versus Yoshihashi. And night five, I liked Sonata and Taichi, especially the finishing sequence there. I liked that match. So those are kind of my personal favorites from those nights. And Tanahashi versus Naito, night five, I also think is worth mentioning because, Kelly, you know, they do the G1 every year. It's a lot of the same guys every year. They fight every year in the G1, not to mention fighting in other matches throughout the year in New Japan. And yet somehow guys like Tanahashi and Naito, who feel like they've fought a dozen times in the G1, are able to make each match feel different. And I think that's really the skill and that's really the talent of a lot of these guys is, you know, they've fought each other before, they know each other very well, and yet they can go out and have a different feeling match and a different story for each match depending on where they are in their career, depending on where they are in that moment in New Japan. So talk a little bit about that, some of your favorite matches in the last few nights, and just your impressions of the G1 overall through five nights.
My favorite thing that they have done with this G1 is the format. And I wasn't sure. I mean, you can't be sure until they run it, because I didn't know, I mean, with seven guys in each block, I didn't know how they were going to deal with those odd numbers and what they were going to present on any given night. But so far, it's been one block match from each block every night. So in the past, where it's been all A block one night, all B block the other night, it's great. You're seeing good matches, but every other show feels like you've kind of been there before because it's all the same 10 guys in these matches. And now you're getting different blocks thrown at you, and it does not feel like you've just seen a show that that you're watching, where you're almost thinking, like, is this a rerun or are these new matches to me? So I really, really have liked that, and they haven't gone overboard with show times, which a couple of years ago, they were going like 4.5 hours on a lot of just regular mid-tournament nights. And I thought that was a little much, especially since I'm the guy who has to watch every New Japan match. So it was really hard on me. I've liked it so far. I tell you what, I'm very snobbish and I'm very protective of my favorite matches of the night, but I agree with all three of yours wholeheartedly. I wouldn't argue with somebody who said that they preferred Ishii and Jay White. That was a banger also, but I would have landed on the same ones. I thought that Shingo versus Yoshihashi might be Yoshihashi's best match ever. He had a one with Okada a couple of years ago that was really, really strong. But I think I would maybe land on this one. I just loved his fire at the end of this match. He doesn't always show that. Yoshihashi's issue is that he doesn't show a lot of emotion at all. Like, he doesn't really smile, but he doesn't give you any other facial expression either. He just kind of looks like a deer in the headlights most of the time. And so even if he's having a great match, he just kind of, he's a little vacant. And I think that people who say they don't like his wrestling, I think that is what they're responding to, is that he's not much of a professional wrestler, but he is a professional wrestler, if you can dig me. But yeah, I thought that the match that he had with Takagi was great, right up there with the tournament. Who did Zach wrestle on night one? Zach and Kenta had just an awesome, awesome match in, I think it was night one. And for me, that hasn't been topped, but man, there's been a lot of good stuff. I'm a big Goto fan too. I know that his time is over. He's not going to win more than, I don't know, I would say two matches in the entire tournament. Maybe they'll let him go 3-3, but I would guess 2-4. And yeah, Tanahashi is in a point in his career where he's being de-emphasized. He's still being used as the superstar that he should be used as when he's visiting AEW. He's still the right guy to slot into that, along with Okada. But back home, he is in the give back portion of his career. And so Tanahashi's doing a lot of that stuff. And as a result, I was stunned to see him go over Naito. Naito's 0-2, and when you've only got six block matches, that's a big hole to dig out of. I think that they probably are telling that story, and that Naito's going to come back and he's going to win the block by a tiebreaker, but you can't go much worse than 0-2. You're not winning the block with 3-3. So I think that's what they're doing with Naito here, because much is being made on commentary of Naito maybe having his unofficial last chance, last best chance at being in the main event of Wrestle Kingdom.
I'm glad you talked about the different system of blocks that they're doing this year instead of the A and B block, the A, B, C, D block. I think that that makes the G1 feel different. And really, you know, the G1 has, I think, lost some momentum the last couple of years with the pandemic and the switching of the time period to the fall instead of the summer. And people just kind of losing track. It doesn't feel as important as it did a few years ago. So I think maybe changing up the blocks would give people a different, you know, a different reason to tune in and maybe see, oh, you know, doing things slightly differently without, I don't think it's ruining the intention of the G1. It's not hurting the spirit of the G1 by doing the four blocks, but it does change things a little bit. And, you know, right now for five nights, we have Tom Lawler in the A block, the Great O'Con in the B block, and Evil in the C block, who have not wrestled yet. And we have some who have wrestled twice. Is that a concern for you in the booking of the four blocks, that it's just so uneven like that?
No, I actually kind of like it. I like the stories they can tell with it. I like that Lawler has been really, that crowd has taken to him a lot. They really like his act. And I think I love that they brought Royce Isaacs over and gave him some shine too. I think he's an underrated hoss in there. I kind of dig what he does too. So having him as the partner, the fall guy, mostly for Tom Lawler when he's going to lose, is kind of cool too. But I like that they've got these things to look forward to. Like, we're still looking forward to Lawler's first block match. And they kind of saved some of these things, and they can make that a story, mini stories, how maybe somebody was hurt by having their matches in like back to back to back nights, and things like that. I really like playing with the format just about any way they could play with it. The other thing I really like about the format is that it does really open the floodgates for somebody to be, that might not be on that main event level right now, but you really want to try to elevate them and see what you can do with it. I think it would be a really missed opportunity if there wasn't one genuine surprise winner of the block, because you don't have to have them win their semifinal match and even get to the finals. Like, their big win can be winning their block, because things like the Royal Rumble and the G1, I feel like once they are tied to having the winner be the number one contender in the biggest show of the year, it not only takes away the organic storytelling you could have told to get to the main event of the biggest show of the year, but it also removes a lot of guys from the equation from even being a consideration to win that tournament. And these are the Rumble and the G1 are the biggest ways in their respective companies to elevate somebody. And I really hope that I'm crazy wrong about one of the block winners, and it's just somebody I wouldn't see coming. Like, I don't want it to see, I don't want it to be Yujiro or Toru Yano. I'm not crazy, but I would love to see a surprise winner in one of these blocks.
I think that's what we look for every year, right? I think that's what there's always a desire for that. And I think going with the four blocks makes it easier for New Japan to run with a surprise than it would be when you just have two blocks and you have the winners have to meet in the finals. So that's another reason I think that the four blocks is tentative thumbs up for me. I'd have to see it play completely out, but right now through five nights, I don't really see a huge downside to it. reaching the top of the hour here. Just a reset. Pro Wrestling Torch columnist Greg Parks here with PWTorch.com contributor Kelly Wells on Wrestling Night in America. Talked about the Vince McMahon retirement news. Talked about Death Before Dishonor. Talked about the G1. And now, because I have to go in chronological order every time we do this. And so SummerSlam. SummerSlam is next. It's next Saturday night. And next Saturday night, Wrestling Night in America goes on the air after SummerSlam, so a special day, special time for us. One of WWE's signature premium live events every year is SummerSlam, so we'll be taking your calls, taking your emails right here at pwtorchdailycast.com next Saturday night after SummerSlam goes off the air. So let's preview this card, Kelly. We'll start with Riddle versus Seth freaking Rollins. This match, you know, Riddle is sort of floundering a little bit without Randy Orton. He had a really good match with Roman Reigns on SmackDown for the titles. But other than that, and floundering and going against Seth Rollins are a worse thing to do. Clearly, WWE sees something in Riddle. They're putting him on pay-per-view in just a singles match, nothing really at stake here against Seth Rollins. But how do you view how WWE has used Riddle since Randy Orton's been on the shelf with an injury?
I was there for that match in Minneapolis where he wrestled against Roman, and I thought, man, if they don't strike while the iron's hot here, this would be a real missed opportunity. So it's good to see he's still figured in, but this was – he was supposed to be the means to the end to get to the Roman match with Randy Orton, which of course is not happening now. So I guess just kind of a victim of circumstance. But yes, they wouldn't put him in this spot with a guy that they've promoted as world champion if they really didn't think there was something there. This feels like the match that I'll kind of sleep on, and then it'll be awesome, and then I'll say, well, I really shouldn't be surprised. I just wasn't overly excited for it. That's what it feels like, that it's going to have show-stealing potential, even though we probably all should have seen that that was a possibility.
For sure, and it'll be a really good match, like you said. And one I'm looking forward to, if only for that reason. We'll move on now to Lashley versus Theory for the United States title. This is one of those feuds that WWE does, and they just never feel like they end. I think this is the third pay-per-view match or PLE match that these two have had, or something close to that. They've had some matches on TV. Lashley winning the title at the last pay-per-view, which felt kind of funny. It's the old WWE booking of, hey, this guy's going to win the Money in the Bank briefcase, so who cares if he loses leading up to it, which is sort of, you know, backwards thinking in some ways. But I guess that's my thought here, is Theory is your Money in the Bank briefcase holder. He has threatened or promised, depending on how you look at it, to cash in that briefcase at SummerSlam. Would they risk having him lose here to Lashley and then try to cash in? I don't see him cashing in successfully, and he's a heel, so he may go back on his word and not cash in. So Lashley on Theory on paper, kind of a ho-hum match, but I think this match carries a lot of aftershocks to it and what can happen after this with Theory. I mean, does Lashley beat him so bad that maybe Theory can't cash in later on in the night? So a lot of different angles and, pardon the pun, the theories going into this match to kind of get us out and get us to Theory cashing in later in the night.
I also think the second Vince left, this became perhaps the most intriguing match on the card in terms mm-hmm. of the ways that it could change, because it was no secret that that Theory is 100% a Vince project. I think a lot of people held that against Theory kind of unfairly. I think Theory brings a decent amount to the table. I mean, it's a lot, and it's a lot at a young age, and you don't want to have another Drew McIntyre V1 on your hands, where you went so hard, so quick, and maybe if you'd just shown some restraint and worked your way up the card with the guy, it would have worked out better. And of course, you know, happy ending to Drew, but it took some years. So this one for me, if Lashley ends up thrashing Theory, it's going to be a lot of fun to think about how that changed and if that changed in the run-up to that. And how, I mean, we see things about how internally they're saying Theory's cash-in is going to be a failure. And I've been thinking that kind of all along, that this was a good way to elevate him, but it might be a little early for a world championship. We've seen, I mean, Sheamus I thought was way too early. Other guys just get a push on that level way too early. But I'm expecting, whether it be at SummerSlam or not, an unsuccessful cash-in. And of course, the longer they wait before it happens, maybe the better his chances are, because you can build him up to be a top contender even while he's holding the briefcase.
If Lashley wins next Saturday night, and presuming that Reigns continues to hold the undisputed Universal WWE titles until WrestleMania next year, is Lashley a guy you think they can plug in to face Reigns between now and then? Because, you know, Reigns isn't going to be on every episode of SmackDown. He's not going to be on every premium live event. So maybe this isn't as big of a concern as it once seemed, trying to fill the Reigns opponent bucket every month until WrestleMania. You're really not going to do that. But if Lashley wins here and beats Theory, is he a guy that they've rehabbed enough to where he could be a legitimate opponent for Reigns, maybe at Survivor Series or at another major pay-per-view or Royal Rumble, if they want to use Reigns at that one?
Yes, not only do I think they can, I think they damn near have to, because who else? I think that that's the biggest and best reason for Lashley to go over in this match, is that you want him to be, and to almost, I don't want to say squash, but convincing win over Theory, and Theory's got to go back to the drawing board. But you do that in the short term because you need some TV with Lashley and Reigns. I don't know why that feels fresh to me again, maybe because they've gone to, in the face of Roman and Brock, it seems like anything's fresh. But I do think that Lashley can be that guy. If you just need one or two to bridge the gap for now, and they may only need a couple of different guys between now and WrestleMania because of Roman's schedule. But for me, Lashley is rehabbed enough.
Okay. Yeah, I think that's a fair take on it. Let's go to Pat McAfee versus Happy Corbin. You know, McAfee has done a really nice job building this up. People love Pat McAfee. People love to hate or just hate Happy Corbin. And so this match is intriguing because this is not McAfee in there with Adam Cole or with Theory, his previous two opponents, who are unquestionably skilled in the ring. It's against a bit more lumbering, less dexterous opponent in Happy Corbin. So this is a different opponent than he's faced before. He's aced his first two in-ring tests. And this should be a fun one. I think that, I think it's going to be good. But is there a chance that McAfee could be exposed here because his opponent is not as good as the opponents he's faced before?
Yes. Or could Corbin finally be exposed enough that they dump him? I was so low on Corbin for so long, and he's grown on me in the level that he's in right now, because they're not trying to promote Baron Corbin main eventer anymore. That's just not in the cards. But I'm perfectly happy with him where he is on the card. This match could be, it really could expose McAfee if it goes 10 minutes. I don't know how you get 10 minutes out of this. other than doing a bunch of goofy, contrived spots. And that's probably what this match is going to be, because if they go in there and try to have a regular old wrestling match, I think it's really, really going to put the crowd to sleep, unless McAfee can just bring a ton of his attitude into it, which he'll do. But I think that there will be a healthy dose of comedy here, and I expect this match to polarize people.
Well, speaking of polarizing, the other celebrity-involved match is Logan Paul versus The Miz. And we spent a lot of time talking about this on the Raw post-show that Wade Keller hosted, and I joined him on Monday, and the attempts to turn Logan Paul babyface. And to sum up my thoughts, you know, I thought Logan Paul did a nice job trying to cut a babyface promo. It's going to be an uphill battle, though, to get that babyface acceptance, because fans are just so inclined to dislike him. And even against a strong heel like The Miz, he seemed not to really get the crowd fully behind him. So Logan Paul is another guy who we've seen who's looked pretty good in the ring. But is this something that's just destined to fail simply because the fans are not willing to get behind Logan Paul as a babyface? Or can they still make it work somehow?
Short answer, no, they can't. This is it's a fine idea on paper, and you could see them moving this way since WrestleMania and since the post-match of what they did with Miz and Logan Paul. But I understand that WWE knows that they've got the oldest fan base of any wrestling company in the world, so they have to try to do something to attract young viewers. But because they have the oldest fan base of anybody in the world, it sure is a ballsy move to promote an influencer, something that old people don't even understand, as a babyface. It just seems like a lot to ask of fans who want to reject anybody who steps in that door and does not scream wrestler, which is odd for WWE fans, like a company that has.
And the standards are high. I mean, when you look at the Bad Bunny celebrity match, when you look at what Pat McAfee has been able to do, Logan Paul did well, but the standards are pretty high for somebody in his position all of a sudden.
Yeah, and I think people just want to boo him. It's ironic that he's against Miz, because Miz has had a couple of quick runs as a babyface, and the guy's just so naturally a bad guy that they were just destined to fail out of the gate. They just didn't make sense. They just did not make sense to waste somebody in that role. I don't know why they're trying to, like, what's your end game for Logan Paul? Why don't you just use him in the role he's suited to?
Well, by the sounds of it, Logan Paul is the one insisting he be portrayed as a babyface. So this could be just WWE acquiescing to what the celebrity wants to get him involved.
I hate to say it, but that tracks. That makes perfect sense. This is the reason people want to boo him. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, you know, I think I did read that at one point and forgot about it. But yeah, that sounds like him. So he deserves every boo he gets.
I'll move on now to let's talk about the Usos versus the Street Profits for the Undisputed Tag Titles. Jeff Jarrett as the special guest troubleshooting referee. And, you know, I think the irony of Jarrett as a special referee being brought in because actual trained professional referees were not doing their job well enough. So the answer, of course, for Adam Pearce was to bring on someone who is not a referee at all to referee. And so that the irony of that is just, I don't know. It's classic WWE booking that they don't even think about something like that and how little sense that makes, but Jeff Jarrett back in the fold is live events coordinator, so he is available to them for this match. And who knows, maybe it will lead to something. Maybe he'll introduce a tag team that will challenge the winners of this match. But this is another one. You know, we talked about tag team wrestling when we talked about Death Before Dishonor. Certainly, this is not going to main event, but we've seen the Usos, the Street Profits, the New Day, different variations of those three teams facing off against each other, having really solid matches on premium live events and on television. And, you know, the stars are rising for these guys, held back by simply the fact that Vince McMahon did not believe that tag team wrestling could draw money for him. So I guess, you know, do these guys go out there with a little bit of a chip on their shoulder with Vince presumably out of power and say, you know, let's go out and show that tag teams can draw. Let's go out and show that we deserve more than just being the opener or the mid-card of a show that's going to put on a really good match. Let's go out there and show that, just like FTR and the Briscoes, that we can main event a major event.
Yeah, 5 years ago or whatever it was, I thought the best match on the entirety of SummerSlam was the Usos versus the New Day, and they were the last match on the pre-show. But they absolutely had the best match I thought of the entire SummerSlam. I don't know if it was a weekend yet, whatever it was. But yes, it's and not only did they bring in a former wrestler to one up all the referees because they can't referee, but they bring in a guy who spent his entire Federation career being a rule breaker. So that's who you want in there enforcing things, is a guy who cheated in kayfabe for his entire career. And I'm actually somewhat interested to see 55-year-old Jarrett try to catch up with some really, really fast-moving wrestlers. No reason why these guys can't steal the show, but if this is booked in a McMahon way, this will open the show.
Yeah. The SmackDown Women's Championship is on the line. Liv Morgan takes on Ronda Rousey. This is going to be interesting for the result. You know, Morgan wins the Money in the Bank briefcase, cashes in later that night, defeats Ronda Rousey, wins the title. Somewhat of a surprise winner of Money in the Bank, but when you look back, she's really shown a lot of improvement on TV. But how long do you keep Ronda Rousey? How long do you keep, you know, does, you know, especially with Charlotte Flair probably coming back, Bayley probably coming back, those are feuds that you want to visit or revisit in the case of Flair versus Rousey. So was this destined to be a short-term reign for Morgan to get the title back on Rousey, just kind of for something to do? Or do you think Morgan is a viable candidate to hold that title for 6 months?
It's always tough for me when I talk about Liv Morgan because I want people to be elevated. I want new faces in the picture. I just don't know if I think Liv Morgan is good enough to be one of those. And I hate to say that, because I think she puts the work in. I have no reason to believe she doesn't. But she's just, for me, she's still just okay. However, that said, I think if you're going to give her a run with the championship, you got to learn what she can do in a championship run. And I don't think you learn anything if you just hotshot the title to her in a match with Ronda and then give it back to Ronda right away. I really would like her to sink her teeth in a feud with some long-term full-time wrestlers and actually see if you've got anything with this reign, because if not, it just feels like her big moment was utterly wasted. If they go back to Ronda here, I don't think they ever go back to Liv Morgan champion again.
Yeah, I think that's a fair comment / criticism. You know, things can, I think that would speak to the fan that this was more about Rousey's journey and having to overcome losing the title than it was Morgan winning it. And so I think that kind of speaks to what you were saying. The other side of the women's division on Raw sees Bianca Belair facing Becky Lynch. We fielded a lot of criticism on Monday's Raw after show about Belair and Lynch, the feud, how people think it's gone on too long, how people thought it's gotten stale. I'm not there yet. I still think Bianca and Becky is interesting to me because of the dynamic and how it's kind of changed in the year that Becky Lynch came back and won, defeated Belair at SummerSlam in 2021. So really a full circle match here at SummerSlam. But what's your take? I mean, has Belair versus Lynch been a feud that you've invested in? Do you feel like it's gone on too long? Are you not invested in these characters feuding with each other? What's your take on how it's been so far?
I am invested, and I still am. I think that this has gone on for just the right amount of time. I don't need it to go on past SummerSlam. I think you put a button on it at the one-year mark. I think that was, if not the plan, it sure worked out really well. And maybe it was the plan, because these two are destined to be at or near the top of the card. So probably not a total mistake that this is where we are at this point. But yes, the shifting dynamic and who they are, Becky especially, in the many, many changes to what's going on with her character and everything, that's worked for me. And I think you just finished this here, I think, with Bianca going over, although where do you move Becky from there? I have no doubt her character will keep her over, but her next move isn't obvious for me. But I don't think this is stale, but I hope they move on from each other afterward.
And then we have Roman Reigns versus Brock Lesnar in a last man standing match for the undisputed WWE Universal title. Billed as the last time ever. So for people who sort of roll their eyes about WWE going back to Reigns versus Lesnar again, that seems to be WWE's olive branch to those fans that says, look, we know we're doing this again, but it's the last time we're doing it. So there is that, which kind of makes you think that Lesnar's going to lose. Because if Lesnar wins, you would think that Reigns would get a rematch. So the last man standing stiff will protect the loser. They're not going to get pinned. They're not going to submit, whatever that case may be. So it's going to keep one of these guys strong. Is there an avenue where you see Brock Lesnar winning? And do you think Theory does cash in at the end of this match?
Brock winning, is there an avenue? I would say none. No, I don't think so. If there was an avenue before, I think there's less of an avenue now after the near walkout, after the Vince McMahon news. It just doesn't – I also don't think it makes sense to squander whatever rub Roman can give on the person who needs it least in all of wrestling. Although, is Roman so godlike at this point? It can only be Brock Lesnar. I don't know the answer to that question. I think I'd be absolutely stunned if Lesnar went over here, but I'd also be semi-stunned if this was the last time ever, because they say last time ever as an olive branch, but they said one time only with Rock and Cena, and then they did it the next year. They'll do what they have to do. I mean, Rolling Stones sold a lot of tickets, convincing everybody it was their last chance to see the Rolling Stones. And maybe to some degree, they knew, they thought they were going home and calling it quits, but they were showmen. They said that because it sells tickets to tell people they'll never have another chance. I'm oddly less interested in this match than I am any match on the card, because I don't think there's any doubt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. I think Reigns wins this. I don't think that Lesnar is going to come out of this as a winner. But then, you know, do they keep Lesnar around? What does Lesnar do after this? You know, again, they can do something where, you know, Reigns piles a bunch of stuff on top of Lesnar and he loses that way. Or maybe they set something up, Lesnar loses by virtue of the guy he's going to feud with next. I mean, if Lesnar does lose, where does he go from here? Does he go off TV for a little while still? Do they keep him on TV in another feud? How do you see that playing out?
I think that Lesnar is short term here only. From the second they brought him in again at the show that I was at with at the end of that Riddle match, I thought that it was, reality set in relatively quickly. I heard his music and I was like, no, really? And of course I should have thought of that. We're in Minneapolis and they needed a different person to, they had to call an audible for SummerSlam. But I mean, within 30 seconds, Wade Keller and I are just kind of talking to each other like, this is probably just short term. This is probably SummerSlam season, needed somebody really legitimate for this one because you can't half-ass the opponent. You can't go Brock Lesnar and Hardcore Holly on a SummerSlam. You can do that at a Royal Rumble. I'm not expecting him to follow up with anything. I'm just wondering if they'll mention him at all afterwards. Maybe I'll eat my words here, but I don't think he's going to be in the mix after this.
Okay. Again, just a reminder to listeners that we will be going on the air next Saturday night following SummerSlam. Once that show goes off the air, we'll be going on the air with instant reaction and analysis from myself, but not just myself. I want to hear from you. So 515-605-9345, same number that you would call tonight or any other night, is what you'll call next week. And you can also email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com. If you can't stay up late with us Saturday night, you can always email us during the show. If there's something that catches your eye or something you want us to react to, you can go ahead and do that. We'll go to our final phone call for the evening. It is the 305 area code DJ from Miami. DJ, welcome back to Wrestling Night in America. What's your first topic for us tonight?
Hey, guys. My first thing is from last week with Titus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Going into his promo, like, the stuff he said was like, his tone and everything, like, something was up. Like, he was like, we can be safe here. Like, when he said that, safe environment. Like, when he said that, I was like, that propped my eyebrow up, like, something's going on. Something that we don't know, something's going on in the back. Where do you guys see that promo, and what do you guys think of that? Like, in the beginning of that, do you think that that was appropriate to bring him out? I understand it was Tampa, but what he said in his promo, what do you guys think?
Well, I gave my thoughts on the post-show with Wade on Monday about this topic. It's obviously taken on a different meaning, or we can look at that promo in a different light after Friday's news of Vince McMahon's retirement. But at the time, Kelly, I thought this, you know, it's kind of followed in the line of Vince showing up on TV and saying, you know, then, now, together, whatever, forever. The WWE tagline that he did on SmackDown the week of the Wall Street Journal accusations. But I thought this was more egregious because, unlike Vince McMahon, Titus O'Neil has a spotless track record. He is a guy who is revered by those inside and outside WWE. He does so much charity work, they named a school after him in Tampa. That's how beloved this guy is. And for WWE to drag him out in his hometown to defend the company amid these allegations against Vince McMahon, I thought it was particularly dirty to me.
Yes, I agree. This is, for all the same reasons you said, it's they took the guy that they knew had the most cachet in and is the best face. The reason he's still in the company is because he is the face that they want to put on all their good work because he's so, so good at it. He's so giving. So to have him be the face of this, I thought was frustrating. And for a guy who went out there and they paired with Hulk Hogan, potentially to handcuff Hulk Hogan because they knew that Hogan might be jeered. And so they tried to put him out there with a baby face for WrestleMania. And then of course Hogan got booed every time he spoke and Titus got cheered every time. Just some of the assignments they've given this guy, I don't know how he hasn't been more infuriated over it, but if he was walking around angry all the time, he wouldn't be Titus O'Neil.
That's true. That's a good point. DJ, back to you for your second question for us.
I just made sure I caught it and everybody else caught it. That was, I was like, was I one in one? Okay, my second thing is Cesaro. Going to Cesaro. It's awesome he won, but it's just like at the end of the day, where's his lead him? He signed for EAW, not ROH. It's just like sooner or later he's going to get beat. Like, but is it going to be sooner than later? Because we all know Tony is like so wishy-washy booking, so I'm scared that this might hurt him. I don't know at the end of the day on this. I mean, I'm happy he finally got a title, but do you think at the end of the day, is this really going to hurt him, or is this really going to push him up the ladder and him, you know, going into higher and better things, or do you think this will just put him in the middle of the ladder? I don't know. I don't know on this. I'm kind of like up and down on with this. What do you think?
I don't think it'll hurt him. I don't think that being the champion of any kind of brand, even one as small and as sidelined as ROH is, will hurt. He gets to carry around a championship with him on AEW television. And we know that there are so many titles in AEW that if you're not carrying a title, you must be a real loser. So Claudio is not going to be seen as a real loser anymore because he has a title. And so, you know, I think ROH and Claudio's contributions to that company throughout his career makes him a pretty good ambassador for what's left of that company at this point. And I don't know when they're going to get TV. So I don't know if he's going to be champion by the time they get TV. Certainly he'll be champion, I'm sure, the next time they do a pay-per-view, Kelly. But what's your take then on Claudio Castagnoli winning the ROH title? Is it going to be more of an albatross for him to be the champion of a brand that really exists only every 3 or 4 months on pay-per-view at this point? Or do you think just being the champion of the ROH brand, which still has a certain cachet amongst especially the fans who watch AEW, will be helpful to him?
It's really hard to say so far this early because we really don't know how Tony's going to use ROH. I thought that it was going to be largely their NXT, but this last show, it's hard to say whether that's the plan or not, because in a couple of cases, they just have great matches with top guys. I didn't mean to say that, but they did, top guys. But they seem like they were not necessarily doing any of the Elevate thing. They were just having great matches with some of their top talent. So it's really going to depend on what this brand is used for. If this is, and I think Claudio's a good choice either way. He's the right choice in the first place because he is an original. He's an ROH original. And even if you were on Twitter all day today and found out there's a whole lot of fans who wanted to complain who had no idea that Claudio wasn't original, but he was. But I think it's right for that reason, but it's also right to me because if this is going to be a place for young talent to grow, to develop, well, gosh, having matches with guys like Cesaro is about one of the best ways you can develop. That's why they used Cesaro when he was Cesaro in NXT at the beginning of NXT when he wasn't champion, but he had a feud with Sami Zayn. He had a feud with, with William Regal on Regal's Way Out. That's the match they were talking about last night where Cesaro retired him. That was on NXT TV. I watched that match in the last 6 months. It's wonderful. But yeah, I think that if they use ROH as a proving ground, then that would be a great person to have be a champion. What I worry about is that they've got too many pieces of talent who want TV time to make any of their TV a proving ground because it's the only way you can get onto TV. I don't think it'll hurt him. I also don't think it'll help him. And I don't know what to think of it until I know what ROH is.
Yeah, I think that's pretty well said. DJ, back to you for your third and final question for us.
I don't even, there's so many questions I want to ask you guys. It's crazy. I have like two more.
You can email us, wnialivecast@gmail.com.
I know, I'm just saying, because I wanted to talk to you guys. Did you guys talk about the FDR real fast or no? I don't remember.
FDR? Well, we talked about the entire Death Before Dishonor card. So, yeah, we talked about FDR versus the Briscoes.
Okay, but you didn't – did you talk about the scrimmage, like, afterwards, like, when they did that great thing afterwards? That was
– No.
Okay. All right. Yeah, I didn't know. Okay. All right. I didn't know, like, what you guys went into with them. All right. I guess we can talk about that next time. All right. I guess because we're going into – I guess we have to talk about SummerSlam. So, okay, if they're going to have this PG-14 thing, right, I'm just confused and dumbfounded with this because, like, does this mean, like, they're going to bring back, like, puppies? Are they going to bring back the king? Because, like, the sound, you know, first of all, you know, with the era, you know, it was a great when they had JR and King. You know, I don't know if this thing is going to work out or they're just going to do, like, a, like, okay, if it's 14, that means that they're just going to do, like, chair shots and tables and do you think that they're going to curse? I mean, what is this? Because now that Vince has stepped away, don't tell me they're going to do something crazy and pull the trigger and bring back Russo or something. I don't know. Like, I'm just confused. What is this 14 thing? All of a sudden Vince left. Like, what do you guys think at the end of the day? Like, I hope they don't do this EAW thing. Just the curse.
Well, much news was made over the last week or so about WWE transitioning from TV PG to TV 14, Kelly. I don't think DJ has a lot to worry about. I don't think the WWE product is going to change all that much. I think simply moving to TV 14 gives WWE a little more wiggle room when it comes to storylines and when it comes to language and things like that. I don't think you're going to see WWE turn into AEW with the blood and guts and things of that nature, to quote Vince McMahon. But I do think it gives them a little more leeway. It gives them a little longer runway to do more storylines of shows that you're seeing on TV. I mean, look, time was, there were certain words that you could not say, even on cable. And now cable is even breaking those words. You're hearing the F word on FX and on AMC and things like that. So what was once taboo is no longer. And in certain ways, I think PG might be handcuffing WWE storytelling. At least this is my best case scenario for it. So I don't think you're going to see a ton of changes, but I think it gives them a little more freedom and a little more wiggle room to do things in a little more adult way, Kelly. What's your take on WWE moving to TV 14 with SummerSlam?
I don't expect much of any changes. A lot of what he was talking about as far as the Attitude Era, that was TVMA. A lot of that, like 14, it wasn't usually 14. They went full on MA for a lot of that era. I'm not expecting much in the way of changes. On NXT, in recent months, they've had guys swear – they had – who was it? Santos Escobar dropped the F-bomb and it was muted or bleeped, but it's very clear what he said. He was saying it into the camera while cutting a promo. Last week or the week before, Cameron Grimes also yelled it out when he was yelling out down the ramp at, I don't remember who it was, Grayson Waller, somebody. He was yelling at somebody and dropped the F-bomb as well. I'm not expecting much. I feel like the TV 14 branding is more to catch up with what they've already kind of done than to actually start spreading their wings any further, because there's a little more sex appeal than there was in the last couple of years, and they're swearing a little more than they were in the last couple of years. I think they're just being honest with what they're promoting.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah, I think that's a good point, too, is it may just be sort of a catch-up thing to what they're already doing. So, you know, I hope that's what TV-14 will represent. I hope, you know, I'm all for more adult themes and less Otis puking on television, but there is a way that you can take that too far, and I hope WWE doesn't do that either. DJ, thanks for the phone call tonight. Look forward to hearing from
you
again
Saturday.
All right. So you can join the long list along with DJ on Saturday night after SummerSlam. Kelly, that'll do it for us tonight. Covered a lot of ground here tonight and didn't even talk about NXT, which is your which is what you cover for the Torch. So you truly are a man of all seasons, a man of all promotions to be able to talk about everything, and we didn't even touch on what you cover. So go ahead and tell the listeners what you do for the Torch, when they can find your work, and where they can find you on social media.
On social media, that is at Spooky Milk or at SpookyMilk.games. Yes, I do the recaps for NXT every other week around that. And I host the NXT podcast as well as NXT 8 Years Back. And I do a lot of covering of New Japan when we do their big shows, their big tournaments, as I am doing now. So, for instance, on this coming Tuesday, instead of doing NXT, that is one of my assignments for New Japan. And kind of bummed to miss the NXT because I'm really interested to see the differences in NXT yet again now that that Vince is out of the picture. So that's mm-hmm. what I do. That's who I am.
Excellent. Kelly, thank you so much for jumping on here tonight and joining me and talking about some of these big events and big news in pro wrestling this week. All right, and don't forget to check us out next Saturday night after SummerSlam goes off the air. We go on the air with our post-SummerSlam Wrestling Night in America. Hope you can join us then. I'm Greg Parks. You can find me on Twitter at Greg M. Parks. You can find my column, whole page, every week in the Torch newsletter. And, yes, I'm going to be one of these thousands writing about Vince McMahon's retirement this week. So look for that in the upcoming newsletter. And we'll talk to you next Saturday. Next Saturday, because if it's Saturday on a pay-per-view weekend, it's Wrestling Night in America.